here this evening and be part of this meeting. I certainly want to thank the committee for the opportunity of offering me the opportunity to be here and to participate and be part of it, and I surely want to thank them for the hospitality that they've shown us since our arrival. I want to say welcome out there to any new people that may be here tonight for your first, second, or third meeting, your first week or two around the program, Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm sure you're aware of the fact that you've now made a giant step forward, that you've now associated yourself with one of the most popular, unpopular fellowships in the world. Nobody starts his life out or his career wanting to become a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't think. But if you have a drinking problem, I can say this without any reservations whatsoever. You never have to take another drink again if you don't want to. What you're going to find here in Alcoholics Anonymous is a group of people who will know most everything about you, yet will still accept you. Who are not necessarily interested in where you've been or where you're trying to go, but we're awfully interested in what you're trying to do today. And that with it itself has got to be a pretty good deal and a break, because when I was out there drinking, nobody was interested in what I was doing that day, unless they heard I was going to jail or out of town, and then they were delighted over that. Other than that, why, nobody really cared one way or another. So you who are new here, I can say without reservation that we care about you, and if you want the sobriety is here. All you've got to do is pick up the telephone and make that call, and you're going to have people down there to see you. If you will this evening, try to keep an open mind, and what you can use, why, take it with you, and what you can't use, why, kick it out of the chair and leave it there. This gentleman ran through a list of names, and there's many speakers, and I'm sure if you'll stay for the conference, you're going to hear the things that you want to hear if you can't find it here this evening. To qualify the beginning statement I made, I'm an alcoholic, and I'm not by any stretch of the imagination an authority nor a consultant on the program Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm an example, good or bad, that AA works, that it has been necessary for me to take a drink, steal anything, or go to jail now for 18 years and 7 months. I don't reckon anybody out there tonight is overly impressed with that statement, but I'll tell you one thing. I'm impressed with that statement, you see. Not only that, but you never know. We may get a pension program going here. And if we ever do, I want to get credit for all my time, you know, so you got to keep bringing these things up. I'm sure to the new people that are out there tonight, if there are any, and I'm sure that there must be some new people out there for your first couple of weeks around the program, you'll find it very difficult to digest when you hear a man say he's been sober for 18 years and 7 months. If I'd have told you I had had a drink for a couple of weeks, you'd have come up to me after the meeting and said, "The hell you have, how'd you do it?" You know, you can understand a couple of weeks, but it's damn difficult to understand anybody out there for that long period of time. Unless you'll try and remember that I've been cutting it one day at a time, and all the people I know on the program that have any length of sobriety, they too have been cutting it just one day at a time. And if you'll make it that one day, the week will go by, and the month, and the year, and pretty soon it's 18 and 7, and you stand in front of a group of people over here in Yuma, Arizona, telling them now you ain't had any booze for that period of time. And it was like yesterday that I walked into my first meeting, and I sat down there and heard the same thing, only the guy had had 9.5 years of sobriety, and I said, "He's the biggest liar I've ever listened to," you know, because I couldn't visualize it. And I didn't hear him say that he'd been making it a day at a time. But for the new people, it is a day at a time, and that's the way it has been. And the time runs fast. I sat there in that first AA meeting, and I was 29 years old, and I thought, man, of all the things I could have been, why am I an alcoholic, you know? I didn't go down to my high school counselor and he said, "Norm, what would you like to be?" And I said, "I'd like to be an alcoholic." He said, "That's marvelous, yes. We have a program for you here." And I went out and tore him up for 15 years and ended up in AA, you know. No, there were a lot of other things I would have rather done or rather been. And I'm sitting there wondering why at this age I am alcoholic. I come from a family of heavy drinkers. Everybody in my family drinks, and they're still out there drinking, you see, but I turned out to be the only alcoholic, and I was very upset about it. And so, you know, because I had analyzed it, as most alcoholics do, and I looked back through my family, and I was able to come up with one giant conclusion: I'm the best in the family, you see. So why should this happen? Why not these other people in my family? Why didn't this happen? So I did like all new guys do. I read some books and some pamphlets about it. I read the big book and talked to a lot of people about why am I alcoholic, and you're hear things about family, you know, and you may inherit this thing. And I look back through my family, and they're still drinking, and so it couldn't have been family. You hear about nationalities, and I think, well, maybe that's it. I'm Irish and Italian. That means you're not overly intelligent, but it means you know a little bit about booze, you know. Yeah. We know how to make booze and drink booze out there, and we're still making it and drinking it, but I turn out to be the only alcoholic, so apparently the nationality didn't have anything to do about it. I got to looking about this environment thing, and I thought, man, that's it. I'm born and raised in L.A., and anybody born and raised in L.A. has got to be hacked up one way or another, you see. But I know a lot of guys came out of L.A. who's never had any booze trouble. They've never been to jail, so apparently the environment had nothing to do with it. After summing all this up, I'm able to come up with a giant conclusion. I am alcoholic because I drank too much whiskey. That's the reason I'm alcoholic. Now, my case is rather simple and is not unique. I had a few other things going for me. I am a rationalizer, a justifier, a compromiser, and I got a rotten attitude. And you don't need any more than that, you see. I traveled half the world and half my life making a complete ass of myself out there. I spent money I didn't have buying things I didn't need, trying to impress people I didn't like, and that's the story of my life until I got here. I run all over hell trying to be all things to all people. In one stage of my life, I felt surely I was the general manager of the universe. And boy, that takes a lot of doing. And it's a lot of responsibility out there to have all of that, you see. No wonder I drank so much. You come to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and you find out what you really are. I looked for all my life. I looked for a way just to be myself, not having to justify my existence nor compromise my life. Be able to spend a day out there in that city street and all I gotta be is me. And it is an experience for an alcoholic if you are like me, because you spent so many years just being everybody out there, justifying your existence about all of the stupid and crazy things you did. And I can sum that up by the story I heard several years ago, and it's clean, so I thought I'd tell it again, about the old blacksmith that was making the horseshoe. And he pounds that baby out, it's red hot, and he throws it down the ground, and there's an old cowboy standing there, and he's watching the whole thing. And he reaches down, and he picks up that hot horseshoe, and he throws it down. And the old blacksmith says to him, "Hot, wasn't it?" And the old cowboy said, "No, it doesn't take me long to look at a horseshoe." The story of my life. The guy says, "Norm, you're drunk there on the street." And I says, "No, I'm not. I like laying on streets, you see." All of my life, I got the screws on, I'm coming behind it, I got to justify the stupid things I was doing, and it's no longer necessary. When I walked through those doors and I came into the program, the man says, "Buddy, you don't need to impress us here in AA, because we've been impressed by experts in AA. So you just come on in and you spend a day in here being yourself, and you take it out on that city street, and you'll spend another day out there just being yourself." Sure, I violated this. I think everybody does. Earlier in the program, I thought I was putting this guy on a little bit, and I mentioned the fact that I'd been in jail about 25 times, and he became hysterical over it. He said, "I did it that many in a year, you know." So, no matter where you've been, somebody got there long before you did. No matter what you drank, you're going to find somebody that drank more of it you thought was built. The only way you can win a story in AA is to be last. And then you're marginal. You know, if they got a side door, the guy comes in and gets you. So you might as well forget it. Come on in and relax and spend a day. It's a gratifying experience to an alcoholic to spend a day just being himself, walking down that street, being him. Tonight I'd like to talk a little bit about what I was like, what happened, and what I'm trying to be like today. Not that I'm here to impress you about the amount of booze I drank or the problems and trouble I had. But I don't know a better way to talk about the program. When a guy says to me, "How does AA work?" Well, AA works by the 12 steps. That's basic. And it also works by one drunk talking to another drunk, and between the two of you stay sober. And what does a couple of drugs talk about? They talk about all the hack and the hassle they had out there. They talk about the grief and the misery and coming to the program and finding a better way to operate and a better way to live. And they talk about things that they have used to help keep them sober. And tonight, I'd like to tell you a little bit. I've told you a little bit about what I'm like. I'm a guy with an attitude problem. And if you got an attitude problem, you're going to have a lot of problems. I started going to jail in 38. Not for drinking in the beginning, but for stealing. I happen to be a thief by trade, an alcoholic by absorption. You see. I opened up the Midnight Auto Supply in the San Gabriel Valley. What that consisted of was stealing automobile parts. It all started out with hubcaps. We just kind of branched out from there. We started getting all the accessories you could get off of a car. Then it got to be such a job to gather up all that crap, we stole the whole car, you see. And overnight, the thing got out from under us. I was a success. I was considered one of the finest car thieves that ever came out of the San Gabriel Valley. And in the 30s, you really had to move to get ranked up there in the top 10, believe me, because we had some fair hookers out there. But it's illegal, and a matter of time until they're going to put the arm on you and you're going to stand in front of a man and he's going to tell you you're going to have to go to the reformatory because you can't get along out here on the city street. You're out there, and today they say you're bucking the system, or you're reacting to life. If that's what he said, that's what I did. I reacted to life and to living all my life. I never took living on living's terms. I always wanted it my way. And I could always rationalize the fact that what I was doing was not that bad. I am a victim of unusual circumstances. It's not me. It's the rotten people. I shouldn't have stood in front of that judge at the beginning. What I was stealing was from people that could afford it. Up there in them busy cities. Felt like Robin Hood. Steal from the rich and keep it. Always, all of my life, I could rationalize that everything's going to be all right. It is not me, it's them. And so from going, being arrested and going to jail and serving some time for this offense, nothing is learned. I came back out on the city street, and in 1940 was the first time in my life that I was ever drunk. It was Easter week, and in L.A., Easter week's a big time. Easter week, Balboa Beach, the Rendezvous Ballroom, Stan Kenton and Padre Beer, and it was a hell of a deal right from the start. I liked it. I am not alcoholic in the beginning. I had a pretty good time with it in the beginning. I got a little sick and beat up a couple of times, but nothing serious from the start. I am not alcoholic in the beginning. Some people feel they are, and I'm sure in their cases it's valid, but no, I am not alcoholic from the offset. I kind of worked at it. I moved out of that Padre Beer into that Rainier Ale, that old Green Death, and then down to 10 High Whiskey. And when I got the whiskey, I found the greatest thing made since money and girls was that whiskey. Boy, that got you there quicker, and I've been in a hurry all my life, you see. That whiskey, you know how you drink it, and the more you drink, the better you feel, and the better you feel, the more buzzy you get, and pretty soon you're up there where you want to be, and where I want to be is there, and there is that plateau that you drink yourself up to, and you feel so good, and you're good-looking, well-built, intellectual, and wealthy, and you get the job done in 2 hours. That's the best deal I ever had up to that time. At 10 High, economically, you never made a better buy in your life. 65 cents a pint, and you could be all things to all people for 65 cents. Frankly, I didn't know it was cheap whiskey till I got to AA. It's amazing, isn't it? AKA, this AA is going to kind of broaden your education out. I also learned some other good things about cheap whiskey. When you threw it up, you didn't lose much. You know? That makes sense. God, if I'm out there drinking that $9 bourbon today and you're flashing that, $9, there she goes. Hell, my God, that's enough to make you sick all over again to throw up $9. But that whiskey in the beginning, it was tough to live with, I'll guarantee you. You know, it's no easy chore. I can remember that first drink I took, that long drag, and that baby went down and it burned all the way, and she's burning coming up, and you know how it'll run out your nose and makes your eyes water? And some guy in the crowd says, "Ain't that good? Oh, that's good, Jesus, yeah." You can barely breathe. It's so good. Well, I kept working at it.
Yeah.
And I can remember the day I could drink a pint of 10 high and never heave a drop, and I thought, you're there now, buddy. It's all right. And from there on in, it was downhill, so as to speak. In January of 1942, I enlisted in the United States Navy. Not because I was overly patriotic, but they didn't give me much of a deal. They had a system worked out. I had had, now I'm on probation. I violated it. I'd gone to Oregon. I dabbled in the car business. I left Oregon and I came back to L.A. And the probation department gave me this deal. They said, you can either go to jail or go in the service. Well, I'd been to jail. It was no deal, so I went into the service. And it was another one of my bad decisions, you see. And I'm sure some of you gentlemen had the problems I did. All of the enemies I had in L.A. joined the Navy the same day I did. You know, as soon as I got in, well, they're trying to tell me what I'm going to have to do and what I can't do and the places I'm going to have to go. And these things upset me. And I went in with a lot of aspirations. I felt that if they would look deep inside old Norm, why, they'd see the talent there and I would be the youngest lieutenant commander the Navy ever had. As it turned out, I was the oldest seaman they ever had. You see? In a four-year period of time, I had three court-martials. I had a deck, a summary, and a general court. The general court-martial was the highest the Navy had to offer at that time, you know. They didn't go any higher than that. In the beginning, it kind of gave me a sense of well-being because I was the only guy on that ship ever had one, you know. And people would point me out and say, there goes the biggest we ever had, you know. And as an alcoholic, you want to have attention. And if you can't get it for being good, be lousy. But the secret is you got to be lousier than anybody else. Well, I made that all right. I was lousier than anybody else. I went down and I was court-martialed. I had an attorney. I was sentenced to 11 and a half months in a Navy prison up there in the top of Goat Island. Through the Everett's attorney and the fact he went for clemency, I was restored to duty. I fulfilled my obligation for 4 years and I was discharged. I had some other miscellaneous things that happened to me. Some 60, 70 days in solitary confinement on bread and water, maybe 10 or 15 captain's masks. Some other things that really aren't important, but the important thing is now that all of my problems and trouble are directly due to booze. If I'm not drinking, I don't have any trouble, but if I'm drinking, I got all the problems that I can, and I can't take care of. I came back to Los Angeles in 46, and I'm alcoholic. I have crossed the invisible line. I'm a compulsive drinker. I'm looking for the answer to living on a quart of whiskey. One's too many and 1,000 aren't enough. A half a dozen people now have told me that you drink too much and if you don't knock off the booze, you're going to destroy yourself and the lives of people around you, and I refuse to believe it. I believe that today. I believe the fact that you destroy and you hurt people. For one of the leading things I heard when I came into the program was that you will directly affect the lives of a minimum of 20 people when you get here and find a better way to operate. In my life, there's 20 multiplied by 20 I've either hurt, used, or abused. Many I could never make any restitution or amends to because they're not available in the physical sense. But in that particular year, I couldn't believe that anybody was being hurt. So when people are telling me this, I say, no way. No, it's not possible. And I went on because I was going to find the answer to living in this quart of whiskey. And in 1946, I was arrested 5 times. It was a bad year. And it was a good year, too. God moves in strange and mysterious ways. You know it, and I know it. And no matter what you do or you don't do, buddy, that's the way it's going to work out. I don't understand why. I don't even care now why. I only know that it happens. I haven't the background, the vocabulary, the education to explain why it happens. It happens. Strange things, and the control is gone. The gentleman upstairs from time to time passes things down. Out of all evil, a certain amount of good has got to come. That year of 1946, I got 2 plain drunk and then 2 drunk driving. And I put on a year probation. Excuse me, a 3-year probation with a year sentence suspended hanging over my head. I went in front of a judge that I knew like my father. This judge and I had kind of grown up together. You know, I'd known him all my life. And one thing about him, he would never lie to me when he said a year or 30 or 60 or whatever it was. I'd always done it. So when he told me if I ever got caught drunk in East City, it would be in violation and I would go to the city jail and I would do a year. And I'm about a half-smart alky. And I think, well, I'm not going to drink in his rotten town anymore.
I'm going to drink in the other towns. And I did for about 2 or 3 months. And then it got so good I couldn't stand it any longer. And one evening while I'm drinking with a couple of friends, why, I commit the unthinkable. I start to think. You should never do that. You should either drink or think, but you should never get them both going at the same time. I got to thinking about that rotten judge, you know, and that lousy town, and this is a free country, and I'm a veteran. God knows, you know, he can't keep me out of there. The big rationalization. I got in my car, drove 75 miles back to the city. I went down to a joint, I took a full load on, I went down one of the main drags, the car pulled in front of me, I hit it and ran from the scene of the accident. Picked up. Cited on a 501 felony, drunk driving, hit and run, bodily injury involved. And but for the grace of God that looks after damn fools and drunks and people trying to make this program, 4 people didn't die. You're talking about that much. A 3.5 feet, a fraction of a second, the snap of the fingers. If I hit that car in the back end, had I hit a broadside at the rate of speed I was traveling, it'd been a total disaster. I had no problem in believing, you see, that there's a gentleman upstairs that looks after folks out there. I also know you're only going to get so many trips out. You're only going to get so many times. As you check into the lottery of life and living, the man said, here's your tickets. You get a handful and you run. And as you go through the lottery of your life, every time you mess up, they got to have a ticket. If you mess up enough, you tap out. You're looking at a guy tapped out, there's no tickets left. And I know the next time out of the chute, it'll be just a matter of time until you move over that 3.5 feet norm, or a man steps off the sidewalk and something happens. When it gets assaulting out there on the street today, that I don't think I can stand it any longer, I like to look back and remember how lucky I've been. Maybe the load is heavy, but it's not quite as heavy as it was when you're out there, and there's no tickets left. I don't stay sober from the fear of it, but wouldn't a guy be a damn fool not to look back and remember exactly how lucky is he? And how many chances you're going to get? When I went out to do the time in that city jail, 150 to 200 guys were doing time. I got a cell and a cell partner. And he's going to AA meetings. Can you imagine that? There's 200 other guys there that I could have drawn. No, they put me with this fanatic that's going to AA meetings, you know. Gosh, he planted the seed. He'd get out of the can once a week to go to these meetings. He'd come back and he was just dying to tell somebody about it. Well, you don't have a big audience in a jail cell, I'll guarantee that. And once a week I'd sit there and I'd get the total. And he would tell me all about it. Then finally one evening he suggested, he says, Norm, I'll fix it with a sergeant. And you and I go one of these AA meetings together. AA didn't come into the jail at that time. The guys used to pick him up and take him to a meeting. He had to be a trustee to qualify. And then they'd bring him back again. And I told him in no uncertain terms, buddy, I don't need any AA. I don't have a drinking problem. I happen to be a victim of unusual circumstances. My problem is the rotten people out there, and once we get that straightened out, it's going to be all right. And I'm too young to be an alcoholic. God, your case is different. Hell, you're 36 years old, you know. What's a man got left after 36? You're downhill from there on out. I don't believe that this year, being 48, you can believe that, you see. But everything changes, doesn't it, you see? Everything all comes home. I said, it's for you old guys that's got nothing left. You go ahead, buddy. I'll go back out and I'll take care of the activity out there. And I went on out for 8.5 years and struggled through. And worked as hard as I could to get here. I drank all the whiskey that I could get my hands on. 8.5 years later, I picked up the telephone looking for Alcoholics Anonymous and a man named Sullivan that I'd served time with in the city jail. I found the program, but I didn't find Sully for a long time. I located him at one time, and he said he'd gone back to drinking after 3 years of sobriety, and he couldn't quit, and he drank his mind up, and they put him in a hospital up there in the state, in a Camarilla for the rest of his life with a wet head. And I found it difficult to believe that anything that tasted as sweet as whiskey could tear a man up that bad. And I kind of let up, and I kind of forgot about him, and the years progressed. And a year ago last December, I was in a meeting on the other side of town in Los Angeles, and when the meeting was over with, the guy came up to me and he said, what's this guy's first name you're talking about? And I told him, he says, hell, that's my brother. I said, where is he? He says, Norm, you're going to find this difficult to grab, but he's been sober now 8 months. And I said, Victor, you and I and your brother, we've got to get together after the holidays and have lunch and talk about old times. And he said, fine, we'll do it. And I'll give you a call. And so January went through, and then February. I couldn't, never heard from him, and so I started looking for the brother, and I found out that he dropped dead from a heart attack. And that, once again, this man had escaped me. Until 5 weeks ago, I was at another meeting on the other side of town, and it was Sunday morning, and I looked down in front of me, and who's sitting there? He's my friend. He's my friend that had been in the can with me some over 25 years ago. And he sat there with 9 weeks of sobriety, trying to cut it, trying to make it. God moves in strange and mysterious ways, and no matter what you do or you don't do, this is the way it's going to be. This guy initially, and I suppose if you wanted to get technically, would be my sponsor. And through the circumstances and chain of events, why now, in a small way, maybe I become his sponsor, so who knows. I wasn't ready for the program, though, when I left that jail. I went out and I went to work for a large construction firm, the largest in the world in the concrete pipe business. I stayed with these people 11 years. In 11 years, I was at the right place at the right time and ended up with a good job. And a good job is a necessary part of my life because it takes money. And you got to have money to buy whiskey. And I'm a bar-drinking alcoholic, and you're carrying a big overhead when you're a bar drinker. It's not like being a home drinker. A home drinker is a low overhead drinker. But you never get the coverage, you know. You don't reach your full potential if you're a home drinker. Who's there to tell how good you are? My wife, and she don't believe it anyway. But if you're a bar drinker, man, you can get out there and circulate and you can let the world know how good you are. I like them saloons. I like them dark lights and the rotten music that hammered at you and the smell that just kind of hung in there. If you had any sinus trouble, you didn't need the desert. You just sucked that baby in, you know. God! But better than anything else, I like the intellectual giants you met in them giants. Man, where do you find the big money? The big spenders and the giants of industry, while they're all sitting on that bar stool about midnight. We're sitting there talking in millions and spending in thousands, and we don't have five between us, but we talk a hell of a lot about it. And we build the castles in the air and form the corporations and put partnerships together and wonder what the poor slobs are doing tonight because the big dough's there. Jesus, you feel it all around you. And when you get tired of talking and lying to each other, you can sit there and look at that mirror, and what's in the mirror? Fine, the mirror is you. They put mirrors in bars for alcoholics so that he might sit there with that Maybelline look, you know, that wide eye. You go into a joint tonight at midnight, you can always tell the alcoholic, look down the bar. There he sits, you know, yeah. He's got that wide-eyed stare. It's like you never saw yourself, but there I am, you know. God, you good-looking devil, you. And you kind of catch sight of your arm as you're bringing that drink up, and you, oh, God, how well-built can one guy get? 150 pounds wringing wet in those days, I couldn't lick my lips, you know, let alone anybody else. That whiskey makes a lover and a killer out of you. Some nights you get so drunk you can't remember what you are, a lover or a killer. You know what face to make. I'm the guy sitting down there on the end bar stool, and I got that $30 smiling Frankie Gordon suit on. I got a dollar's worth of whiskey right down the front of me. Little chili and mustard mixed on my necktie. You smell bad and you can't talk, and I'm one step away from disaster. If I got to go to the men's room, it's all over, you know. It's a big step down from the bar. There he goes. The lover of the San Gabriel Valley, there he is. Or you make some cute remark to the bartender after he's 86'd you. And he comes around, and now he gives you 87. That's opening your head with the door. You see, clank as you go through. Out into the gravel parking lot to get that pavement rash you get from Alcoholics are subjected to pavement rash. You know, that scabs all down his face from having his head in parking lots a lot. Or falling in bushes. Pyracantha bushes are dandy. They hasten your entrance to AA, you know. And then you crawl off to your automobile, lay down in the front seat, and go to bed. Car sleepers. AA is filled with car sleepers. This also helps you get here. How long can you walk around with a bent neck, you know, from having your head screwed under the armrest all night? What an experience when the sun runs through the windshield and your head screwed under the armrest all night. What an experience when the sun runs through the windshield at 6 o'clock in the morning and it hits you right in the eye. That's called a spiritual awakening before AA. You come to attention there in the front seat and you're throwing up straight up in the air, you know. Or on your dashboard. Or you thought the window was down, it was up, blah, all over that. That's an experience no true-blooded alcoholic should be without, you know. That rap as your head hits the window. Crunch, you know. And yet you sit there and say to yourself, I'm having a good time drinking. Yes. I'm enjoying every minute of it. I've got to get the hell out of L.A. because they've got rotten whiskey in L.A. I must get back down to Big Spring, Texas. God, did they love me in Big Spring. Or was it Dallas or Seattle or Moses Lake, Washington or Stockton or Phoenix or Tucson or on and on it goes. When in reality, you know what it was. Every time you went to some place, like, nothing changed. With one exception, it got worse. It never got better. About that time in my life, around in 1947 when I was going full bore, my bar associates suggested one of my major problems was that I was single. They said, you should get married. Once you get married and settle down and have a family, everything's going to be all right. They said, don't go off half-cocked. Don't make sure this woman's got a job. You know what? Well, I've been running around with this red-headed Irish girl, and we decided to turn the trick. And we got married, and she had a decent job, and everything was going our way for 2 months. And she came home from the doctor. She said, I've been to the doctor, and the doctor tells me I'm pregnant, and I've got to quit work. And it found that very difficult to believe, you know. Did you ever tell an alcoholic something you don't want to believe? I didn't want to believe that. But she assured me that she was home free, and so you kind of become big-hearted, and you think, well, that caper takes about 9 months. I'll give her 2 to get on her feet, and we'll get the rotten job back again, and then everything's going to be just like it was. Hell, that was 25 years ago, and that woman ain't turned a tap since that day, you see. She got herself in that shape 8 times. I couldn't believe it. And down near the end, you know, you're sitting there on that bar stool, sucking on that booze, saying, how can she do this to me? And I'm rarely home anymore either, you know. This was a great disadvantage. The responsibilities are things that alcoholics can't tolerate. It's the responsibility. Not only that, she's red-headed and Irish. She was 115 pounds, stood 5'3", and when I was drunk, she frightened me. Well, you're out there drunk for 2 or 3 days, and you come home, and you're tired. You know, you've been busy out there, and you're coming home, and you're tired, and you're a little drunky and a little sick, too, and you walk in the house, and you'd like to have a little love, a little affection, and a little understanding, because you've had a terrible time out there. Then from 20 feet, she says, you're drunk again. And I'd always come through with the same remark. Who, me? Like 37 guys are with you. You know who the hell she's talking to. But you got to get her on the defensive. You see, that's very important. And I say, who, me? And she'd say, yeah, you. And then I'd hit her with that one that always got her, right there. I'd say, woman, do you know who you're talking to? Don't that get her right there, though? And she'd mimic me as only the way them Irish could do it.
Do I know who I'm talking to?
And in case she didn't know, I'd introduce myself to her. Yeah. And I say, woman, you got one more chance to shut that Irish mouth and apologize to me for what you just said, or I'm leaving. And she's hysterical by now. She goes down and throws all my clothes out. And I pick up all my clothes, and I carry them out to the automobile. The old clothes packet alcoholic. God, he's a joy to the neighborhood, isn't he? When you get tired of watching the late show, you can sit out and watch him. Here he comes, you know. God. Some nights he forgets his trousers. Here he comes. Load of clothes, snagging them in the back seat, yelling at everybody. He'll be sorry. I'm driving away. 2 days later, driving back again. Sunday afternoon is the prime time to come home when everybody's out working in the yard. And here you go. You're so drunk, and you got the death grip on that steering wheel. You had a flat tire, you're too drunk to change it, and you drive on it. You've now joined a unique society within an AA called the Rim Drivers. The old tire flopper poppers. You know, here you come down the street you're living on. You turn that car into the driveway, you park that baby up on the lawn, open the door, and fall out. There you are out there. Getting up off of the lawn, the first thing that would come to mind would be, I wonder if anybody saw me. If you're a true alcoholic, you flounder through life thinking, nobody knows I drink. No. But my sponsor set that straight. He says, Norm, after you admitted you were an alcoholic, you become unanimous, because everybody in the 11 western states knew you was a bum but you. And sure enough, it comes to pass. You pull yourself up off of the lawn, you walk in the house, and you stand there, and you go through the third act with this woman, you know, this baby, Jesus. Give me a break. Now, don't throw me out. I got a hell of a deal for you. You know what I'm going to do for you? I'm going down, and there's a new priest down there. I'm going to take a pledge for you. Pledge number 73, I think it is. I'm going down, and I'm going to take that pledge. Think of the kids, you know, the tears. Okay. Give me a break. I got a hell of a deal, you know. God. Finally, she relents. You bend it. You chink. And you go in, and you lay down. You start to die all over again. And the old head starts to move. The schemer. Alkies are schemers. As soon as she lets you in, then you start to scheme how you're going to get out again. You see? Get a little booze and start all over again. Because you're home free. You got a place to stay, someplace to sleep. You don't have to sleep in the car. And on it goes. Until eventually, no more. You run out of time. The booze takes every loving thing you got if you give it enough time. All it needs is time. But the wheels of alcoholism grind very slow and very fine. You give it enough time, it gets it all. It gets every loving thing you got that means anything in your life. One day I went home, and I don't live there. She says, Norm, you're a drunken bum. You'll never live to be 35 years old. You're drinking yourself to death. Get the hell out of our house. The kids are neurotic because of you. I'm scared to death of you. I sit here night after night waiting for you to come home. I hear a siren run down the street, and I think, my God, the cops got you. For this time, they find you laying dead in the middle of the street, Norm, you're never coming home no more to us. And we can't go any longer. You've drug us down in that gutter as deep as you're going to get us. You broke my heart for the last time. You've hurt me. You tore us out. I'll always love you. But you've tore out all the feeling I ever had for you. We don't care about you one way or another. And you walk out to your car and you drive away. And you say to yourself, why me? Why me? Jesus, why not Fred and Charlie? They're all bums. I'm not a bad guy. The big rationalization. Why? And you and I know why. If you consume enough long enough, it's a matter of time. Sure, there's isolated cases where people put up with this crap for 30 years. Always hoping this jackass is going to straighten out. 30 years they watch him flop in and out of the house. 30 years picking up the pieces. 30 years of lying for him, 30 years of promises he could never keep. On and on, God gives him a lot of strength and a lot of help, and it's kind of a left-handed thing, I believe. I wouldn't put up with it 30 days, let alone 30 years, but they keep hanging in there. Thank God they do, huh? Because you see some true miracles in AA when that happens. You watch a man and these women coming through the door for his first AA meeting. Boy, he's all torn up and he's sick. And you look in the woman's eyes and she's sick too, but in a different way. And the story in her eyes say, this guy has tried everything there is. None of it worked. And this isn't going to work either. I don't think so. But I'll try it. Now you see the same couple a couple of months later, they're walking through the same door. And the guy, he's all sharped out. And he looks good. And you look at his eyes. And the eyes are clear too. And you look in the eyes of the woman, and what do they say? The story has changed. There's happiness. There's some form of contentment. And it says, I've been waiting 20 years for this to happen. And finally it's happened. And today we're happier than we've ever been in our life. And it's all made possible through a unique miracle that we choose to call Alcoholics Anonymous. I can't guarantee to the new people out there tonight that this is the way it's going to be, that it always works out that way. No. The only guarantee we can give you here in the program is sobriety and a way of life. And if you're a ditch digger, buddy, you're going to be a better ditch digger. We don't guarantee you're going to make a ton of scratch and drive a big iron or live in the big house on the hill, or the woman's ever going to have you back. But if you'll stick around and buy the package, we'll guarantee you those two things and a little bit more. We'll guarantee you that someday the respect of your people will come back. And that's a hell of a lot more than you had when you got here, the respect. The day will come when they will respect you if you'll buy everything that's available here on this package of Alcoholics Anonymous. Losing families is not enough sometimes to bring people to the program. Losing the respect of the people I work with and do business with is not enough. The day the old man called me in the office and says, the next time I get you drinking on the job, you're busting through and out of here. And you'll never leave L.A. County for us again. Never. We'll send a guy out on these jobs half as good as you think you are. And I left his office. Humility. Humiliated. Hey, alcoholics know a lot about humility. We could write volumes on it because we've been humiliated so many times. The humility of that experience. Out to the joint that night, sit there and drink that booze and think about that rotten bum. How could he tell me that? After all I'd done for that company, how could he do that to me? I'm going to fix his wagon. I'm going to quit. Yeah. I'm going to form my own company. And then I'm going to run them out of business. And then he's going to have to come to see me for a job. And he'll walk in my big office, and I'll say, get the hell out of here. I remember you. And then you know what happened next? I had another drink, and I fell off another bar stool, and I dreamed another dream and built another castle in the air. And I didn't surrender until a man walked into my life, and he says, Norm, you've abused the privilege of owning it. We're going to have it. And he took away my self-respect. The day the alcoholic recognizes he has no self-respect is the day that the psychological second, the turning point, that he's willing to change and to do something that will restore him to the dearest and greatest thing he ever had, is self-respect. The day comes when it's no longer important what people know about you. No, no. The only important thing is what you know about yourself. And as you stand there naked, the day you are born, and you know within yourself you got nothing because you got no self-respect, and you know it. That happened to me in February, God willing, in 1954. Plus money's a hell of a walk, but that's the way it is. Well, needless to say, I was a little upset with him. I didn't particularly like him, and I didn't like the way he was talking to me. I'm a very sensitive person. All alcoholics are very sensitive people. And so I got into my car that night and I drove down to that meeting. The Temple City Group that used to meet in Rosemead. Guys from El Monte, Baldwin Park, Azusa, and Monrovia used to go there. Nobody ever went there from Temple City. Isn't that strange? No, it really isn't strange because that's Alcoholics Anonymous, you see. That meeting now moved, and they meet in Arcadia. That meeting never got to Temple City. Isn't that a hell of a note? I just throw that in the venture on our side of town, looking for that group. If you're looking for it in Temple City, don't, because it's now in Arcadia. In any event, I went down to this meeting, and we used to meet in a Legion Hall there, and on the corner was a liquor store, and then the meeting, and then the cemetery. And the cliche of the group used to be, if you can get past here and stop there, you won't make it over here. And then they'd show you that cemetery. And they'd all laugh. You know, if you keep thinking, you're going to die. Ha ha! Subjected to the warped sense of humor of the alcoholic after he gets sober. This group is a very wealthy group. We had so much money in that group in those days, we used to have donuts before and after the meeting. Can you imagine anything like that? And we always bought a half a dozen jelly donuts. We'd save them for new guys. You see a new guy coming through the door, and he's green and hung out, and they come up and say, how'd you like a jelly donut? You know, God, no! You're looking down there at something you left on the street last night. I want a donut! And the only good part of it was that if you stay sober long enough, you could do it to the next new guy that came in, yeah. And then he'd all stand back there and go, you see him? I thought he was going to choke over there, very funny. Yeah, alcoholics, you know, after they get sober, everything kind of gets twisted. Well, what do you do when you go to the first meeting? Well, you're introduced to maybe 6 or 7 people. And they're all standing around. All 6 or 7 people are talking at the same time. And every time that some guy gets down to the punchline of the story, some guy interrupts him right there. You spend all your years in AA going around, you know, in limbo. You never get to hear the end of any story. No, you never get a chance to finish anything. In the beginning, you think, when the guy says, keep coming back, well, you think, well, maybe that's why, you know. Someday I'll hear the end of one of these damn stories. They just talk all the time and smoke cigarettes and drink coffee and talk about everything, and people interrupt all the time and they just keep right on talking. And your first meeting, you know, it's kind of strange. And this is only the beginning. You sit down there and then some jackass stands up in front of the group and he tells everybody what a jackass he is. And they become hysterical. The more jails he goes to, the more he's worked over, the more people beat him up, the sicker he gets, the greater the laughter, the finer the love, and they call it AA. What a strange place. But it works. You see, it works. And then the man starts to talk about coming to the program, of finding sobriety. His life begins to change. He buys the package. And over a period of years, one by one, the children that he had came down to see him. And I had the foresight that night to look around. I'd seen a half a dozen guys sitting in that audience, big tough guys. And they're all choked up. And a couple has got tears in their eyes. And they're crying because they're happy. And the story of Alcoholics Anonymous was told that night, as I understand the story. They laughed because they were miserable, and they cried because they were happy, and they called it AA. Sure enough, how do you clear away the wreckage of the rotten, lousy past? How do you move that junk out of there? You learn to laugh a little. No alcoholic laughs too much before he gets to the program because there's nothing to laugh about out there. But if you keep coming back and you keep attending these meetings, and in spite of yourself, one evening you're going to be sitting at the meeting and you're going to start just a little bit to laugh a little. You'll, ha-ha, oh God, don't let them see me, you know. But no matter how tough or how hard you think you are, if you keep coming back, the day's going to come when you're going to start laughing a little. And you start bringing the junk and the garbage up, and you're not laughing at the guy, you're laughing with him. You're not laughing at yourself, you're laughing with yourself. And you start moving the junk and clearing the garbage and the wreckage of the past. And then the day comes when you buy the total package. The day that you quit taking, you start to give. Takers. Alcoholics are takers. I'm a taker. I took all my life. I stole every loving thing there was out there. I thought I had the key to happiness as I laid out there and I took. Hell, I never had the key change. I never knew what happy was all about until I come to the program and learned you can't be happy, buddy, unless you give. You can't keep what you have unless you give it away. And we've got the facilities. You pick up the ashtrays. You make the coffee. You go to central service, general service, institutional work. 12-step calls, dozens of ways to give yourself for the hell of it. And your reward from this is insurmountable. And a man says to me after a meeting one night, he says, "Well, Norm, this reward, what the hell are you talking about? What do you got that's so big? You know, if you're talking about something, my friend, in a material sense, not a hell of a lot. But in a sense of well-being, I got it all. And I got a lot more than I had when I got here. It's been a long walk from the L.A. County Jail to the point that I stand right here. And it's a lot more than I have right now than when I came in. It doesn't take a mathematical giant to figure it out. When I got here, I had nothing. And any way you want to cut it, nothing from nothing leaves nothing. So every loving thing I got today is a lot more than I had when I got here. And I got the big package because I bought the package. I've got a sense of well-being I'm able to experience from time to time as I walk down the street. Feeling good all over the night you go out and make a 12-step call on the guy. And you sit there about midnight, you're dead tired when you went in, but you're not tired anymore when you sit in that car. And the feeling comes all over, and you just feel good. And it's what I looked for when I drank the whiskey. I wanted to feel good. I wanted that sense of well-being. And I drank myself up to that plateau to get that buzz on to that sense of well-being. And I had one more to stay even, then down the chute. And in and wake up in the morning, the sense of well-being is gone. And in its place is a friend of mine called remorse. And he reached in and he tore my guts out again. And the only way I put it out of my life was to have a little whiskey. And I had a little whiskey and I would be restored again to a state of some kind of sense of well-being. I traded that sense of well-being in. The sense of well-being I feel in Alcoholics Anonymous, and all I've had to do is give a little of myself. And I'm sure in the end result, when you stand there and they're hanging you out to dry, it's not what you've accumulated in a material sense that's going to make the difference. It's what you give away that'll make the difference. This I understand. This I believe. I'd like to tell all the new people out there tonight that after coming to the program, that every day is a holiday and every meal's a banquet after you get here. But this isn't so true. You're going to have your good days. You're going to have your rotten and your lousy days. We're going to give you the equipment to stand out there and be counted just like the rest of them. Everybody goes through phases in their program. Sure, 3 years and 2 months sober. And the job is getting to me. I've been passed by 6 times for a bigger and a better promotion, and it's eating me up. I'm working 10 hours a day, and I'm hating them 10 hours a day. And it got to the point that I couldn't stand myself, and I couldn't stand anything. And it got so bad, something had to change, and I sat down and took a good hard look at myself. And I went to a meeting and heard the Serenity Prayer, and I must have heard it 50 times before that. But for the first time in my life, took a hold. It said, accept the things you can't change. And there it is. Accept what it is. There's people in this company, you know, that will never forget who you are and where you came from and what you did to them. And you're going no farther than you are here. So you're going to have to stay here and accept it for what it is. Or you got another choice. Because you're sober, you got another choice. You can leave. And I went in and I resigned and I left the corporation. And I went out and went into a different environment, a different type of work. I made a 180-degree turn, a different vocation 15 years ago. And I haven't missed a meal since. And it's all made possible through this program we call Alcoholics Anonymous. Sure, it got pretty rough before it got better, but I think that these things are so necessary. It makes you a little stronger for what's coming later on. I don't look forward to these things, but they come in because that is life and that is living. In 1962, I walked out of the St. Luke's Hospital and I stood out there in front of Christ and all, and I said, God, why? Why me? God, you tore me up bad again. The heartbreak and the grief and the misery you've asked me to pack is too much. I can't cut it. God, I've been sober 8 years. You know, why do you do this? I forgot to remember who I was and where I came from. I forgot to remember that God's a kind man. He never gives you a bigger load than what you can carry. He gives the big crosses to the big horses and the small ones to people like me. Norm, instead of standing there crying the poor mouth about what you didn't get, why don't you thank him for what you got? And please, would it become Solly tomorrow, God, give me the strength to thank him for what I have. And what I have is so much. I've got 18 years and 7 months walking down the sunny side of the street. That's what I got. Guys are going to die and never see 18 days, let alone 18 years. They're going to walk down the street of booze and fantasy and busted dreams and broken hearts. Tears by the bucketful. They'll never get on. I'm overpaid, for you see, I woke up now year after year. Woke up and make the decision of which way I want to live. Nobody makes that decision for me. I make it. Nobody has got the heat of the screws on me. I make the decision. I justify my existence to nobody out there. I will not compromise my life. I will leave and I will walk down the sunny side, and I will walk with my respect for me, and I will be respected by people, and I'll hide in no doorways, and I'll talk to people, I'll talk, and I'll look them in the eye, because I don't have to hang my head from none of them anymore. I'm not coming from behind. No way. They got the screws on me. I am respected by myself. And when my day's work is done, I will get in the car and drive home. That's what I'll do. And I'll drive home to my house, and I'll see my woman. And she's redheaded, and she's Irish, and she's the same old chicken. And when I walk in the house, I'll be respected by her. Because I'm her old man and she's my woman. I'll be respected not for where I've been or where I'm trying to go, but for what I am today. And I'll be respected by the children who are in the house. And nobody will cry at my house today because the old man is drunk and tore it up. I'll hear no kids screaming me, not strike your mother. I will be very fortunate in these 18 years because I will raise them up. And I'll send them to school. And I'll get them educated. And I'll take a daughter's downtown. And I'll buy her a pair of high-heeled shoes. And I'll watch her move from a chicken into woman. And I'll stand there and feel the respect that she has for me because I'm her father. And the respect that I have for her because she's no longer the little girl, she is now a woman. And I'll take another down and buy her a prom dress, and I'll get choked up again. I will take a daughter, and I'll get her married. And I'll send out 400 invitations, and people will come. And I can remember the day that I sent out 400 invitations for people to come to see me shot. Nobody comes. But that day, out of 400, some 350 people came, and they sat in the church, and I walked down the aisle with a little girl who had become a woman, and I took her down and I gave her to a big jackass she married. But you know, before old jackass ever got there, there was just her, and there was just I. And there must have been 5 seconds when we stood there kind of squeezing each other's hands. Tears are rolling down, her face and mine. And I'm looking out at that sea of people and thinking, God, how lucky can you get? You're part of this thing here. And Norm, what do you see out there? Well, you see your friend and Charlie and Bill and Ernie and the rest of these guys from AA. And they look sharp, too. And they look at you and they say, Norm, you look sharp. Everybody looks fine. And you know what's in their eyes. They're trying to say, Norm, too bad the rest of the people here in this church don't know you, huh? Too bad they don't know who you are, where you come from, and what it took to bring you here. And it's those moments you want to shout, say, Jesus, yeah, Charlie. Too bad they don't know, huh? Too bad they don't know who we are and where we came from and what we have. Too bad they don't know our friends. Too bad they don't know Alcoholics Anonymous, because but for the grace of God and these friends and Alcoholics Anonymous, I could have missed it all. Thanks a million. God love you all.